Roger McGee's in.
Joined.
Has it become way very expensive with speculation or unauthorized trading outside the IRA policy framework?
This question is the discussion of speculation. Now, the transfer policies that are being discussed in three of the five regions actually are an attempt to deal with the situation. And what's really at issue between the various policy discussions is the degree of regulation that's going to be done. Now, some people have said that these are amateur regulators doing this business well. Regulators in this case
joined.
Are the people implementing the regulations or the policies, and those are the IR staffs. And I submit that they are no more amateur than the in regulating what they're supposed to be implementing than the regulators of a government agency or in doing so. Because the last time I checked, there's no university that produces a regulator degree. There's no training certificate that you can receive that says you are a regulator and so forth. And the IRRs, like government agencies, regulatory agencies, look for certain characteristics of the people they hire to do the job. So the other half of the story is, where does the source of these regulations, this policy, in the cases the government has done through some sort of legislative process or other process that the government has adopted. In the sports world, it's done through governing bodies. In the IRRs, it's done through the communities. So, here again, these are the people that are using the resource, and so how much of an amateur are they in trying to determine how to use their resources? So the market discussions are an attempt to control the advent of speculation. One of the things that works counter to speculation is the fact that these IP addresses must be usable, they must be routable, and if they're not routable, they're useless. And so the involvement of the IRR as, in effect, a title agency is important, because it's only the IRR that can specify the uniqueness of the address in terms of being related to a specific user. What is the effort for making the secondary market across five regions? This is basically the same discussion we just had here with the previous question. There has certainly been in the past people attempting to buy and sell and trade IP addresses. Perhaps you're aware of something that just popped up on eBay. It's not the first time that something like that's popped up on eBay in terms of someone doing this. Again, it's a matter of usability. When you receive an address from this person, how usable is it? Are you actually buying a very useful automobile, or are you, in fact, buying the Brooklyn Bridge? Five, are the ISP responding to the challenge of IPv4 address pool depletion? I would say yes, they are. Because of their participation in the policy process, they are concerned. They have businesses to run. And it's a matter of where they think they are in the position. There are a certain amount of corporate decisions that are required. The upper-level corporate managers are becoming more and more aware of the situation in their particular businesses. And so it then becomes a judgment call on the part of the corporation to do so. Alain Durand, who's sitting here from Comcast, will tell you exactly what Comcast is up to in this area. They have made a strategic decision here. So it is a strategic and tactical decision that is made by the ISPs. And so what can be done to encourage them?
Wrap up, please.
I am wrapping it up as fast as I can. Stop interrupting, please. So what can be done to encourage them? Well, the IRRs are probably doing as much as they can in terms of the communities are doing as much as they can in terms of policy. But most of it now becomes a matter of bodies and organizations outside of the IRR community. Statements by organizations such as the one that Mark McFadden represents, I think he'll maybe be talking about that a little later, are important. Statements and activities by governments, such as the statements by the government of Japan, are important. Fiats and policy implementations, such as that of the U.S. government, are important. So these are all things that are important. Statements by bodies such as ICANN are important. And so therefore, those are the things that are being done to encouragement and more things that can be done. All the IRs have increased their outreach activity in this area to increase the awareness in the upper levels of corporate management as well as in the government circles. So that is what is being done. So with that, I'll say thank you.
Thank you very much, Ray, and sorry for interrupting.
One quick question.
Yes, please.
The paper that we were discussing is on a table out to the front back there for those that came in late. So please help yourself.
Right.
Unfortunately, I did not have time to get it translated, so it is only in my native language, English.
Thank you so much. And I'm sure you have many questions, but we have no time for question and answer right now. So please bear until the last panel, and we have perhaps, if all the speakers go within their allocated time, we'll have 20 minutes to discuss. Ray, could you, you have a slide? Leslie, right? Could you pass the cable to her? And so the next speaker is Leslie Daigle from the Internet Society. She is the Chief Internet Technology Officer and also heavily involved with IETF and other technical activities. So she'll give you the technical overview for the coexistence and stuff like that. And for those who came late, there are other handouts. I think the staff has prepared that, from including OECD report and flyer. So if you can pick them up, that's great. We have some more chairs than the IPv4 addresses, I think. Any secondary market, you mean? I just got it, so if it doesn't work, I will display. I got it, so shall I do that, or you got it? Looks like yes. So you have some 10-minute-ish.
Sorry for the delay. So I have very few moments this morning and an awful lot of ground that could be spoken about, so I would like to just focus on a few events from the IETF and the technical world in general, and then touch on how they relate to ensuring that we have end-user interests assured going forward. As you may or may not be aware, there have been a number of recent events in technical fora related to IPv6. There were several events this year, several at the Network Operator Group meetings, one at the recent IETF meeting, and I think Ray Ray and others have mentioned the RIR IPv6 events. Largely, these have been events to get the technical community's feet thoroughly doused in IPv6, which ultimately trickles up into more concrete decision-making based on real experience in the community. Some common themes from the public events. Actually, I'm not even sure this is the right presentation. This is kind of disturbing. And ensuring that people had a useful user experience out of the event. I'm going to skip some of these because the real presentation actually is shorter. So one of the key things focusing on the IETF event is that it actually focused on a strictly IPv6 world. There was no transition to IPv4 in the network as it was set up and operational. This is not an attempt to reflect the real world, but rather to reflect the world to which we wish to engineer. I think it would be very upper right-hand corner of Ray's graph. Ultimately, we wish to be back in a realm which is not interannum, but rather globally addressable in a unique address world. To get there, we need to engineer for it. The RIR events and some of the network operator group events have been focused on having that kind of support for both IPv6 and IPv4 in as much of an interoperable fashion as possible, and those have brought out some interesting features. Some of the key things that I think really do need to be discussed this week in the context of ICANN are things like the fact that it's actually fairly difficult to get IPv6 glue records in the DNS in some registries and registrars. This is something that needs to be addressed across the board in order for people to actually be able to seriously uptake and deploy IPv6 for their own enterprises and their own realities. It is also the case that in trying to make IPv4 and IPv6 play together using NAT-PT, some implementations are finicky. This is simply a case of systems being available and, you know, put together as more or less first-generation products. And what's needed is a lot more use by people. These things need to be deployed and made operational. Yes, one of the things that was interesting in this year was that a notable entity from the IPv4 internet world, Google, made available an IPv6 accessible site, ipv6.google.com. And part of the interesting thing in that effort was their stated rationale for it. I mean, the obvious one, that IPv4 addresses are running out, people are recognizing this. But also, with mobile devices and appliances coming along, the general need for a lot more addressing, that NAT is a partial fix, it's not a total solution, so we really cannot extend the lifespan of IPv4. And again, this is coming from a major internet presence. This is not the technical community trying to sing a particular song. And they also recognize that early adoption is crucial for long-term success. And they wanted to be ready for when their customers wanted it. Now, this is the Google rationale as they've presented it publicly, but I think that we can recognize that this is rationale that's applicable to a lot of other entities as well, and it's part of how we will ultimately get to continue to have a successfully functioning, addressable realm. You can find much more information about what they did and why they did it in this URL. I imagine that the presentation will ultimately be made public, and I would recommend you get it from there rather than trying to scribble it down now. And then I think I'm going to skip most of the rest of the material here because I believe others will cover it in more depth. So that's pretty much a whirlwind tour of some of the things going on in the technical community. I would say one of the key things that is true at this point is that it really is a focus on when we, you know, get more serious about IPv6 deployment, not about if IPv6 is going to happen. And that in itself, you might note, is a major change in the last 12 months. And this is a good thing. So what remains at this point is for us all to grab hold of the rope and pull, as it were. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie, and saving some time, so I may give you an additional question. One, do the end users have to worry, care, think, consider, act?
At this time, end users, whether they're individuals or enterprises, should be aware, certainly aware of that this is coming. If there are, and Jeff Houston's making faces at me. I think that, Jeff, I don't see how you could possibly think it would be inappropriate for an enterprise to be aware that IPv6 is coming at this time, because there are certainly internal systems as well that are going to have to be IPv6 aware. So an interesting story for you, Jeff. Coming back from where I was last week, the VP of a large U.S. ISP sat down next to a blind woman on the plane in a class that I wasn't flying in, sadly. Anyway, he got off the plane afterwards. He says, it was really interesting. You know, I sat down next to this blind woman and, you know, told her a bit about what I do, and we exchanged whatever, and she turned to me and said, so when do I get my IPv6? So sorry, Jeff, and the end users. So they should be aware that it's coming and should be asking essentially of the availability of and the support for V6 in software. And as we saw, some of the implementations are buggy, and deployment is needed in order to work out the bugs.
Thank you. While we keep on, could you pass me the cable so that we can prepare? Somebody can hold it. Just 20-second question if you have. You need them. Yes, just say it. The question is end users, but also the responsibility for the vendors. I'm for the translation, I'm sorry. Okay. Question also centering the CPEs for the end users is very hard to obtain.
Yeah, and I would certainly agree that today it would be very hard to say that I want to, you know, I'm going to go home today and I'm going to get my IPv6 address from my ISP and set it up and make my network work with IPv6. And that there is no answer to that today, but in a large part the effort here is to make it clear that there is a desire for it, because it is only customer demand that is going to cause those product lines to be developed.
Okay, sorry. Ray, yes, you have the floor, and then we'll move to Karine.
Okay, I quickly wanted to bring into focus what we mean when we say end user. I'm sure in most people's mind what they're thinking about is somebody sitting at home with a laptop doing something. And actually, end users in this case are all those people on the edge, whether they be suppliers of information and services or whether they are the consumers of information and services. So certainly those people who are providing mail service or are providing banking services or governmental services and so forth are clearly end users as much as those persons on the other side of the edge who are consuming those services. So I think it's very important to note that. And there are specific actions that those suppliers of services that can do in terms of their outward-facing services becoming IPv6 capable as soon as possible that are important.
Thanks, Ray. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Karine Persett from OECD. OECD made a very interesting comprehensive report and published in May, and many copies are there here in the room. But Karine, please.
Thank you, Izumi, and thanks for inviting me to this workshop to talk about such an important topic as the transition from IPv4 to IPv6. And really what we're talking about here is the future of the Internet and its ability to scale, to connect billions of Internet end users and end uses, and a lot of these new end users and new end uses. As Izumi said, I'm from the OECD, which is an intergovernmental organization of 30 member countries. These governments come to the OECD mostly for comparative statistics and data, for analysis and to cooperate on cross-border issues. So an OECD report, and the title is Economic Considerations in the Management of IPv4 and in the Deployment of IPv6, was made public about a month ago. The goal of the paper is to raise awareness on the need for industry to continue to deploy IPv6 and manage IPv4 given existing economic drivers and barriers, as well as the need for governments to act as early adopters and promoters of IPv6. So the OECD placed this overall theme in the context of a ministerial meeting on the future of the Internet economy that took place in Seoul, Korea last week, and where some of you were present. Yeah, I look around the room. Some of you were definitely there. So why is the IP address issue relevant to public policy, and therefore why should governments specifically care? Well, first of all, as all other organizations that depend on the Internet, governments do have to face the depletion of IPv4 addresses somewhere around 2010, 2011, and they have to plan for IPv6. So it's an issue for government institutions just as much as for the private sector, because they need to be able to grow the public services they offer online. Secondly, deploying IPv6 widely on the Internet and beyond just public institutions is necessary to make space available for more use of the Internet and the development of new services, basically for growth and for continued innovation on the Internet. And again, to go back to governments, they care a lot about framework conditions for growth and innovation. In addition, in the future, it's likely that economies that move to IPv6 first will have a competitive edge because they'll have accumulated expertise to develop new products and services that leverage IPv6 functionalities, mostly the widely expanded address space. And thirdly, there are also potentially competition concerns if new entrants cannot gain access to IPv4 addresses. And Ray touched upon this in his introduction. Once we've run out of unallocated IPv4 address space, new entrants will still need to be able to acquire V4 addresses to talk to the V4 world. And the OECD, the organization I work for, is generally very concerned with competition and does view this as a potential problem for open competition. And there are also security and consumer protection issues involved if transfers of previously allocated V4 addresses start to take place, but there is no tracking of what address space is assigned to whom. Today, the RIRs do track the assignments, but that's mainly in the case of assignments of new address space as opposed to transfers of previously allocated ones. And that's an ongoing policy discussion at the RIRs. But I'm just making the link with public policy concerns. So next slide, please. So the OECD report, and which is a bit long again, sorry about that, basically recommends three roles for governments to play, and I'd like to clarify that government's role, in our view, is not about regulation. The first role we see for governments is to help increase education and awareness of the issue with the private sector. Since the issue is as much a business issue as a technical one, we feel it needs to be more and more on the radar screen of business decision makers, and speakers before me have said this as well. Also, a real challenge during the transition is interoperability between V4 and a V6 Internet, and it is in the interest of governments to help promote interoperability so that everyone can talk to everyone else. Governments can also try to help to ease some of the bottlenecks, and I think the report by the Japanese MIC study group on Internet smooth transition to IPv6 contains pretty good leads and identifies a lot of the relevant issues and stakeholders. The second role we see for governments is to plan to adopt IPv6 for their internal use and for public services. and that's normal strategic planning, and it also helps increase market demand for IPv6, which has been pretty low, to say the least. And finally, governments need to cooperate internationally, and also it is critical for them to monitor the evolution, or to help monitor, or to be aware of the monitoring efforts of the evolution of IPv6 deployment. So as an example of international cooperation, and just because this is pretty recent, happened last week, just got back, governments, an OECD ministerial meeting on the future of the internet economy was held last week in Seoul, Korea, and the main outcome of the meeting was the adoption by 45 governments plus the European communities of a declaration, a ministerial declaration, which is a political commitment. It contains a section on IPv6 based on the analytical report we mentioned before. And it says, we declare that to contribute to the development of the internet economy, we will encourage the adoption of the new version of the internet protocol, IPv6, in particular through its timely adoption by governments as well as large private sector users of IPv4 addresses in view of the ongoing IPv4 depletion. So it is a political commitment, and it's a start, whatever else you might think about it. Another recent example of international cooperation and initiatives is the European Commission Strategy and Action Plan, which is ambitious and concrete and sets a 25 penetration target by 2010. I guess Bertrand Lachapelle will talk about this a little later on. So next slide, please. An important final point that I'd like to make is that monitoring through measurement and statistics is considered by us, by many people actually, to be essential for informed policy, be it public policy or technical policy. For example, to meet a target of 25% IPv6 penetration by 2010, that the European Commission has set, we'll need to define how to measure IPv6 penetration. So we think it would be good to investigate what measurements are feasible, who could gather what data to track the deployment of IPv6, what questions would the data be answering, what kind of funding would be necessary, and who would be able to provide such funding, and what methodologies could be put in place so that data that is measured by different parties can be aggregated and compared internationally, and we can have an idea of progress. So moving forward, we and the OECD and all the stakeholders involved would be really interested in exploring with other interested parties any potential cooperation to help put in place statistical methodologies to measure progress in V6 deployment. And again, our role is probably going to be limited. We'll need to. It really depends on the statistics and the methodologies that answer the right questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Karine. Before moving to the next speaker, that's myself. Just one burning question: have you done any cost analysis? Because it's an economic consideration. How much are we going to have to spend?
What do you mean cost analysis?
Well,
a global cost analysis,
yeah,
of what it's going to cost for the entire...
Well, you quoted some of the studies somewhere in your report that it may cost billions of dollars, something like that.
I believe I've only come across one study, which is a study by RTI International, I think under contract with the U.S. Department of Commerce. Those which gave some big picture numbers, they're not comprehensive measurements of the cost, because the cost is going to vary so much depending on each specific implementation, on what it's for, on whether value add, on what the existing systems are, on what and what needs to be upgraded, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very difficult question. I would love to have an answer to that question, but I don't. Sorry.
Okay. Sorry about that. I read in RTI estimated that in the 2005 value of cost for all stakeholders groups to transition to IPv6 in the United States will be approximately $25 billion. It's very rough estimate, and there's a danger, of course, but it's Ray, yes, correct me.
Not speaking of that, but to expand on two of the remarks that you made, Karen. First of all, transfer policies already exist in all of the regions, so it's not a new thing. What's new is changing the nature of the transfer policies. The second thing regarding IPv6 penetration studies, Aaron recently conducted one and reported on it at our recent meeting in Denver, and we will be proceeding to continue to do that further. Now, this initial penetration studies are obviously focused on the penetration of IPv6 in the Aaron region, but anyone that's interested in that data could go to the Aaron IPv6 wiki site, which is getipv6.info, and find that information. We are interested in expanding this penetration study, and we're looking for additional partners to help in this endeavor, wherever they may be in the world.
Alain Durand, Comcast. Would like to expand a little bit on the issue of cost. It really depends on how things are done. If you plan ahead of time, you can actually roll some of the IPv6 costs into the normal upgrades, normal cycles that you have in your network, and you can dramatically reduce the cost, and essentially it becomes a training cost instead of an equipment replacement cost. So planning is really the key to all of this. Now about $25 billion in the U.S., I don't know where this number is coming from. I can probably pull my hat and take another number that will say something half of that or twice of that.
Merci. 20 seconds.
Yes, well, just one small comment on the fact that governments should be early adopters. It's a good idea indeed, but one has to remember that governments are also content providers to the citizens. And the main issue I hear from the people running these internet services for governments is that they want to give the users the same experience as they have currently with IPv4. And just for the same reason that Google has started a search engine on a specific host name, because they did not want to put the main Google search engine on dual stack due to mostly slow speed for the IPv6 connection. For the same reasons, it's most government content websites will most probably be put in a specific IPv6 domain name, which means that in the end it will get less exposure than the IPv4 website.
Okay. Now we'd like to move on the case studies. Is Adil finally here? Or? Okay, then, well, anyway, I'll do my part and see how it goes. My name is Izumi Aizu, and I'm a member of the Large Advisory Committee from Asia-Pacific, but this time I'd like to share some of the findings of the Japanese government study group on Internet Smooth Transition to IPv6, which started last year in August, I believe, and came up with a final report in April under the public comment, and they have just released an English version and a summary. And I made a summary of the summary. This is the overview of the report. The first 2 points essentially says IPv4 address will run short as early as the beginning of 2011. To cope with that, the transition to IPv6 is an estimated essential action. Then they compared with some other approaches like use of NAT and reclaiming the unused addresses. So, and the challenges, they have made some action plan, but they say the providers of the networks and service should create an action plan themselves in 2008, this year, for compliance completion by the end of 2010. And it's important for users to advance the supporting IPv6 through the modification of our system's renewal, assuming that the internet connection with V4 will be limited after 2011. And it is also important for product suppliers, such as vendors, manufacturers, and technology suppliers, such as SIs, outsourcing to strengthen the support system for network and services. And it is important for government and relevant organizations, such as an address administration organizations, to support the whole progress. This is the overview of the possible influence or consequences of address space exhaustion. And it may become impossible to develop the internet further unless there's some possible measures there. And the services that users receive via the internet are also greatly influenced. And we are dependent on the internet so much so that it will be fairly serious. That's the conclusion. And they have compared different approaches, as I said, on the utilization of NAT and NAPT and reallocation of the IPv4 addresses. And they made some observation about the feasibility, service continuity, and the permanent effect versus short-term sort of gain. And there's only the last result is it is essential to transit to IPv6. But how to do that? So they made some more technical observation on how to really make the two networks and services applications coexist. And here it is. It's the current state of the V4-only network we all know of. And then we need to perhaps set another network called V6 network, but there you have translator or IPv4 V6 translation plus application layer gateway. As a novice user, I don't know what exactly they mean, but you have to do something to make the intercompatible for both. And in the beginning, there's not much traffic across, and they hope to make more traffic. But in the early stage, they'll be therefore see more use of the NAT and NAPT and the translator. And at the middle stage of exhaustion, on to the right, there's more red thick lines, which means the more of the usage of the support of the IPv6. They have also analyzed extensively, and all these presentations and real full report are already on the ICANN's at large website or wiki website, and we'll perhaps put them all onto the ICANN's meeting, Paris meeting website as well for details. And so they started from the PC and network-connected home appliances like the, you know, hard drive recorder. They have some IPv4, but not compatible V4, stuff like that. And they put some analysis on the devices like CPEs. And then these are all for the consumer users, so they also analyze most applications, including voice over IP or streaming or dynamic DNS and the P2P and NTP. But they also looked into the middle-scale users, more or less on the corporate users, middle-scale, and the large-scale users. And they also made some observation about routers and switches and IDS, IPS, intrusion detection system, or these security measures. And they made more observations about antivirus software to database to all these NTP. So these are sort of for most end users, we are not really aware, and we don't have to study much about these, but they are the tools which made internet working behind the scenes, and I believe most of these, or for most of them, should be interoperable between the two networks. So here's the action plan. First, they sort of made some demarcation between networks and services and users, and these should be implemented by mostly network services and users, but immediate parties primarily. But you need indirect parties also need to collaborate to solve them together. That's the action plan of 5 years. It's a little bit difficult to see, but from 2008 to 2012, and they assign the task to each actors, namely networks, services, manufacturers, SIs, users, and others. Finally, the government. I have no time in going into the details, but it could be a template. And finally, they define the role of the government in the action plan. It is extremely important that each player recognize its role and promotes the action for itself by themselves. So, but for the government, publicize the Japanese policy internationally so that the international trends will conform to, or confirm to. That's the first action they said. So that's part of the reason why I was asked to actually share this presentation today and onwards. No country can really go ahead and then you see, look around and others are not really with you, and then it doesn't work. International coordination is very important. And as Karine said, some of the findings of this report has been fed into the OECD report, I believe. So promote the development of IPv6 compatible supporting communication devices. Examine the support for the initial cost burden in cooperation with relevant organizations, and the support the enhancement of education programs for engineers to learn the appropriate skills. So these are sort of the details of the action plan. And so they have an IPv6 promotion council, but that should be re-strengthened, reconstructed, because they have been primarily involved in the promotion of the IPv6 per se, but now they have to also deal with the technical areas and stuff like that. So here's the URL. That's my report. Any burning question? URL? Okay. But it's also on the ICANN Wiki website or ELAC website. Is Adil here? Then we'll, next, move on to the next part, which is the panel. We have Bertrand de la Chapelle from the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and also, as a personal capacity, you come from GSE GAG. Could you sit next to Janet? Thank you, Bertrand. You have about 5 minutes, if you can manage, please.
Thanks, Izumi. It's a great pleasure to be here. I won't take long. I just wanted to highlight a few points. The first thing is it is extremely important that discussions like this take place, and especially that they take place in a truly and fully multi-stakeholder environment. What I mean by multi-stakeholder is that IPv6 or IPv4, IPv6 transition is fundamentally one of those issues that are very, very, very hard to address if each category of actor is addressing it on its own. Everybody has a piece of the puzzle. It's just like trying to build the whole puzzle and everybody has its own piece, but unfortunately the piece he has is not fitting with the other piece he has unless he deals with somebody else who has the link in between. So this kind of discussion, so that there's a common understanding of the objectives, the challenges, and what should be done, is extremely important, and I think ICANN is a good space to do this, and I really commend the at-large in general for fostering this discussion. The second thing is, as you had the opportunity to hear the French minister say this morning, we are very, not concerned, in the wrong sense of the term, but interested and we consider important that the allocation of the remaining pool of IPv4 addresses is done as fairly and equitably as possible, taking particularly into account the needs of developing countries or those who haven't been served so well in the past. I do not have a precise formula of what fair and equitable is. It's just setting an objective that is a common objective in a period where we're going to a situation of increased scarcity. So managing scarcity is, by definition, a policy question. The originality of this subject is that, unlike some other subjects, the policy responsibility is shared. It is not only the responsibility of governments, it is the responsibility also of the technical actors, it is the responsibility of the commercial sector, it is the responsibility of everybody to come up with a common vision and a common objective. So fair and equitable repartition is potentially a common objective, and we have to discuss what are the best means to do this. And the last point is fundamentally, two last points. The other point is this notion of coexistence that you have, that Izumi has illustrated. I think the notion of smooth transition is a very good formulation. And in those types of subjects, finding the right formulation for the goal is 80% of the work. Because if we agree that the notion is smooth transition, that the objective is smooth transition, it is a guideline for most of the things that we want to say. It's not like a switch on, off. It's smooth transition, which is a very different concept. And so the last point is, if we're talking about smooth transition, how do you handle smooth transition? And the few figures or diagrams that Izumi has shown show that basically it involves a lot of different sub-actions by a lot of different actors. And it's not the moment to really outline this. What I just want to outline is that here again, we're confronted with a typical policy question, which is how do you create a common benefit when each individual action is not immediately beneficiary to you? And so this is a typical public interest question. It's again a policy question, and again it's the responsibility of everybody. But this notion of what kind of mechanisms can we find so that individual actors, not only individuals, users, but also individual governments, companies, and so on, are encouraged and find an incentive to do something that is not immediately beneficiary, but it is absolutely necessary for the long term. It's a typical game theory type of situation where it's more than a win-win. It's creating value together and having a common benefit. So these were the few messages, and I hope it fits well in your discussion.
Thank you very much, as usual, your crisp observation. And now we have the pleasure to announce a second speaker from France, our hosting country. I think the French are very good at cohabitation, but may not be necessarily good for the smooth transition of the administration well. But here, Alain Durand from Comcast, but I believe you're originally from France. I sleep good.
Oui, je suis français. But maybe I would speak in English. I would like to first talk about this governance issue that Monsieur de la Chapelle mentioned earlier. One thing that is important is to understand that the system to allocate addresses is a very complex system. It is a fine balance that has been reached after many years of discussion within the IR community. And we are concerned that some ill-considered last-minute changes into this model will actually throw this highly evolved system out of balance. So continuity in these changes is very, very important. And in Comcast, we do think that the continuity of this internet public governance model within the IR, within the ICANN structure, is actually the best way to handle those changes. Now, about IPv6 and deploying IPv6, I would like to share a little bit about the experience that we have had in Comcast over the last few years. The company made a strategic decision to embrace IPv6 back in 2005. We have decided to do it in two phases. The first one is for internal management, essentially using it for our own infrastructure. And the second phase is to go on services that will be customer-facing. Right now, we are at the moment where we deploy the phase one, and we are thinking about how to handle the phase two. We try to do it in a way that will not be extremely expensive and that will be actually technically feasible. Because we use technology to solve problems, and we don't use technology just for technology's sake. So one of the first tenets of our approach was to say, we are going to use IPv6 where it is necessary and nowhere else. There is no point in using IPv6 to communicate between my laptop and my boss laptop. But when we have millions and millions of devices where IP address scarcity is important, using IPv6 is critical. When we deployed it, we realized that it was not so much a networking problem, putting the gear together, that was fairly easy, but it was really a layer 7 and 8 problem, as we say in the technical community, meaning this is an application problem and this is a service problem. We realized that there are lots of dependencies, both internal and external dependencies, and they could be dependencies on a piece of software, or they could be dependencies on a service that we subcontract to another company.
And managing all those dependencies is what is difficult. Many, many times when I talk to an external party, I say, oh, we have our IPv6 requirements, we would like this new feature, and the message I get back is, oh, okay, well, you are the only one asking for it, and I have 21 other requests from many of our customers for those IPv4 features, so unless you pay for it, well, we are not going to do it. So this is essentially what we had to change and what we did change in a lot of sectors. For example, in tools like DHCP, we have been working with the community, both open source community and product, to actually make sure that such solutions do exist. So vendor engagement, and by vendor I don't mean only software, but I mean also services, is really, really key. And you made a very good point that this is not something that we could do just by ourselves. Cooperation with other service providers, cooperation with the rest of the industries, meaning anywhere in the essentially in the food chain, being suppliers of services, suppliers of product, or consumer on the other side, is really, really important. Now we are moving on to services, and if I may just get your projector, I would like to show you a picture. Because as a good Frenchman, I believe that a picture is worth a thousand words. So this is a diagram that essentially shows what a service provider can do. And so there's a service provider at the core that is running out of IPv4 addresses at some point in a few years. And he has customers that are at the bottom, like small home networks that are connected to the network. And on the right-hand side, things are going to the internet. So what is orange in this diagram is IPv4. What is blue with various shades of blue is IPv6, or various flavors of IPv6. Well, we are facing essentially two problems here. The first problem is that in the home, people do not only have the latest and greatest computers. They also have some older computers that cannot work with IPv6. And even if they just bought the latest Windows machine a few months ago, they still have an old one that was working very well, and they expect to use it for another many years. So simply saying, we are going to provide an IPv6 service, is not going to be a solution, because we need to handle the legacy. We have to make sure that we keep providing service to older machines and older devices like PlayStations and other home devices. The next issue is that even if we have new IPv6 machines in the home and we provide services to them, well, those eyeballs are looking for content, and the content today is only available in IPv4. And it's going to take several years to take the entire content on the internet and to migrate it to IPv6. This is going to happen, this is going to take time. Meaning that we as service provider in between need to develop some interim solutions that are going to help us to essentially bridge those two worlds. And essentially it comes back to a technical problem, which is that IPv4 and IPv6 are not compatible. So we are trying to develop some new technologies to make IPv6 backward compatible with IPv4. This is something we are doing with collaborations with other service providers and other vendors, and we will do that through the standard bodies, something that we want to standardize through the IATF, and this is going to be something extremely important to enable this deployment of IPv6, making it backward compatible with IPv4, and that will be the end of my remarks.
Thank you, Alain. So we look forward to hear from you again for your progress on this backward compatibility thing at our next workshop, perhaps. Now we have the pleasure to have another speaker, a long-time ICANNer, or ICANNer, Mark McFadden from the British Telecom across the Strait of Dover.
Thanks. My name is Mark McFadden from BT. Before I get started here, one of the things I wanted to say was just because of some of the other speakers have done such a wonderful job outlining what the challenges are and what some of the solutions are, I wanted to mention that BT does indeed have a IPv6 service available. And at the current time, the demand for that service has really not overwhelmed our ability to support it. That much said, I want to share some perspective of the kind of thought that's going in a large ISP as far as what is needed to make IPv6 work. Elaine said some very useful things, and I'm going to not repeat some of the things that he said, but sort of share a slightly different perspective. The first question is, one of the things that you'll sometimes hear is that ISPs are not deploying or supporting IPv6. To the contrary, we know that many, many ISPs are already deploying IPv6 in their networks. But one of the things that you've heard and one of the things that is evidentially true is that there's no serious demand for it. So customer demand actually as a market force does drive deployment. Yet we're seeing, at least in Europe, many, many companies actually provide IPv6 service, if not to residential customers and end users, as someone talked about earlier in the workshop, then to corporate networks. And remember that not all ISPs are the same. We use the word ISP here in this community and try to think of it as if it's just one thing. But there are many, many different kinds of ISPs and sizes of ISPs. And so one of the things to recognize here is when we talk about ISPs deploying IPv6, we might be talking about small regional ones, very, very large carrier-oriented ones, ones that are only interested in providing NGN-type services, and so forth. And so it's important to know who's providing the access when we're asking the question, do ISPs actually deploy IPv6? It's also important, and I think very, very interesting, in that in a variety of regions around the world, there are some really strong attempts to motivate demand based on non-market principles. And the OECD paper here is important, but you see governments actually trying to motivate demand in ways that are not related to simple market dynamics. And several speakers, Bertrand did a wonderful job of saying that it's many people's problem, and so many people are going to have to join hands in the solution. And that's what we see here. I think customers are not the only issue, though. And in my last two slides, let me talk a little bit about where I think some of the problems are and some of the challenges are. In BT, we, amongst the people who talk about IPv6, we talk about something called PCNA, provision content and applications. And Elaine talked about layer 7 and layer 8. And I'm sorry to say this slide is just about layer 7 and layer 8 here. One of the things that is a problem for many large-scale ISPs is that the tools to actually do deployment of IPv6 are not mature yet. That's a fancy word for saying not ready for prime time. And so we're working with vendors. Elaine's words were really excellent here, vendor engagement, to try, and the vendors are very willing and very, very helpful here. But it's not quite ready for prime time, wide scale, 40 million customer deployments of IPv6. The deployment tools that are very, very mature in the IPv4 world are not really mature in the IPv6 world. Second of all, Elaine, and to some extent Bertrand, has talked about content. My mother fully expects to get the content that she's interested in, and she doesn't want to know about the stack. She doesn't care. And I think that was Jeff Houston's point early on, was that end users, when this moment comes, when we can do deployments of 40 million customers, end users should not have to care about how it works underneath the covers. And my mother, at 78 years old, certainly doesn't want to know. The next part of PCNA is applications. Certainly, applications ought to be transport agnostic, or to put into English. The applications shouldn't have to worry about how the packets move back and forth underneath. This is the layer model that Elaine talked about. What we see right now is that some applications are good at this, but other applications are missing. And this is a place where the maturity of the applications developers, again, has to work in cooperation with the content developers and the people who are doing provisioning. Like I said here in my last bullet, I don't want my 78-year-old mother to have to worry about which protocol she's using.
Thanks, Mark. And
can I have the next slide?
Oh, sorry.
but you're welcome. better than you, Ray. I just got cut off. You got a minute warning there. So the thing here, and the great thing about coming after Elaine's presentation is I don't have to say many of the excellent things he said, but a very important thing as we think about this and work in partnerships together to solve the IPv6 deployment problem for end users is to remember that ISPs are not a homogeneous community. They're many different kinds, many different sizes, and have many different kinds of problems in terms of actually bringing pure IPv6 or tunneled IPv4 over IPv6 service to customers. I can tell you that speaking from the point of view of a large ISP, there is tremendous amounts of work going on in our organization in terms of doing planning for both the architectural design, the service design, and how the retail channel will work with IPv6. And a lot of that work is driven by customer demand. And I might say, and this is something that no one else has said to this so far, but our own internal infrastructure requirements are requiring IPv6 as well. A lot of the discussion that goes on in our organization are how do we go about meeting the operational issues, and Leslie talked about this earlier, how do we actually solve the problem of meeting the operational needs, what things work, what things don't work, and in Elaine's words, which I think are really excellent, making sure that there's some vendor engagement in order to make that work. So Bertrand's point about partnerships is extremely important, and as an ISP, as a large ISP, we found that it's absolutely crucial not to do this by ourselves, but to do this engaged with all the people from both the retail chain, the applications chain, layer 7 and layer 8, who are stakeholders in the process. Thanks, Izumi.
Thanks, Mark. And to prove that the ISPs are not homogeneous, we have the extra pleasure to have our local host ISP here in Paris. He is, Christian Jacquenet, and he is from the France Telecom R&D, Director of Strategy Program for IP Networks. And before he starts, I was told that we can do some extension because originally it is scheduled to end at 11:30, but we'll have 10 or 15 minutes more with the indulgence. Thank you. And you have the floor, Christian.
Thanks, Itsumi. It's pretty hard for me to be the fourth speaker considering the material that has been disseminated earlier. I fully agree with your previous comments, obviously. V6 has been quite a long story within France Telecom since we started back in 1995 with the evaluation of the first commercially available routers. The motivation for such an experience was basically twofold. One, acquire the know-how, and obviously as a consequence, number two, get ready whenever comes the time to deploy IPv6 capabilities in our networks and services based upon the IPv4 address depletion forecast, which remains obviously from our perspective the key driver. The V6 program, which has been quite recently launched, is actually a three-phase program, which is basically decomposed into introduction, migration, and production, obviously preserving the interest of our end customers as much as possible. That is to make sure that whatever the kind of service they have subscribed to, they would get the appropriate level of quality, reliability, and security, even though if it's V6 formatted. In other words, we don't think we will sell V6 per se, but V6 is seen as a means to not only address the IPv4 address depletion issue, but also to make sure that they will access a faster, more efficient, and hopefully more reliable internet. Obviously, from that perspective, standardization is key. Alain has already mentioned one of the various issues we are currently experiencing. From our perspective, we've got three main technical issues. One is related to the evolution of our home gateways to make sure that the people who will be connected to the internet will be protected from any kind of malicious attacks, considering the fact that there will be assigned global IPv6 addresses. This somewhat questions the basic private address management scheme that we have enforced so far. The other issue is related, obviously, to make sure that any kind of communication can be established between V4 and V6 hosts defense, going to the presentation that was made by Alain in particular, and also by Mark. And the other issue for us is the evolution, or at least the impact of introducing V6 capabilities onto the information system, considering the charging and the subsequent management facilities that need to be provided and hopefully adapted to the introduction of V6. That's basically my point, considering what has been said earlier. So I guess we can be ready for the Q&A. Thanks.
Thank you for a very succinct voice from France Telecom. I'm aware that there are many experts on these matters, almost world top-class people, as well as a layman on the V6 issue, but a very top-notch expert on the policy or public policy issues, and then the users and the trying to represent the users. And now floor is open. But before going into that discussion, I think the overall theme is how to create synergy, above all, and within the ICANN community, and perhaps with others, depends on how you define others. There's some interesting notion of non-market principles that we are facing the common problem. There's no economic incentives, at least in immediate ways. Otherwise, we don't have to be here. Just let the market decide and the customers pay. Thirdly, perhaps we see some other technical challenges on top of policy issues and combined such as security issues. Any of these are of your interest, we can hear, debate. There's microphone floating for the translation here and also teleconference. Please use the microphone if you want to say something. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned. Or
come on, please.
Yes, Leslie and then Patrick.
I just want to throw in something that occurred to me listening through some of the further presentations. It's important to elaborate that while we all know what our desired end state is, which is to say deployment of IPv6 or at least continued global addressing, we also need to remember that it's not possible to mandate or even build a perfect plan to get there. That's not the way the internet works, and that's actually a feature. One of the things that I think is really unique about the internet is the fact because these things happen when people pick up the pieces and each person does their own part, there are aspects of it that are going to take a lot longer than we could ever hope for, but there are other aspects of it that are going to go a lot more quickly. And it's very hard to predict, even though we would like to have the indices and the measurements to make the predictions, very hard to predict what's going to go where. To give an illustration of what I mean, 20 years ago, the hot topic in hypertext research was how in good gracious are we going to take all of humanity's physically published books and ever fund the processes to actually get them converted into electronic form. And it was seriously a hot topic. And then the World Wide Web happened, and the topic went away. So keep that in mind.
Well, regarding the residential market, we are here in Montparnasse, and I have the impression that we are somewhere in Roland-Garros, because people are throwing the ball at each other. There's no demand. Of course there's no demand, because there's no offer. And just to give you an example, before coming to this meeting, I sent an email to the press service of my CPE manufacturer saying, well, we have this meeting in Paris. Please, if you have something to say about that, as a major CPE manufacturer in Europe, maybe you should be there. Well, they didn't even acknowledge the receiver of the email. And last time I called their support, all they could say is, sorry, we don't support IPv6. And that was it. So, and their argument say, we don't support IPv6 because ISPs do not provide IPv6. So in the end, how can we, at one point, generate a sufficient demand so that both manufacturers and service providers can indeed start provisioning the service?
Just to go a little bit further on Leslie's comment earlier, I've just come from... Hello? I've just come from the NANOG meeting about a month ago in New York, and we had an hour where IPv6 was the only mechanism that was available for connectivity, and most of us were disconnected for that hour. It is not easy, and when you look at it from an operational point of view, that it's not easy. When the operators themselves cannot get IPv6 to work, I think believing that there'll be a change in the next 2 years is highly unlikely.
The last point that were made essentially in the line of we need to make sure that there is some kind of evolution path between IPv4 and IPv6, and that certainly goes through making IPv6 backward compatible to IPv4. If not, we are simply running into a network law that has been expressed by Paul Melcalf, which is that the value of a network is the square of the number of users. We have a huge IPv4 number, a network with a lot of users, very large positive value, and almost no IPv6 users with first very little value. So we need to break this by making those two compatible.
Yes, I just wanted to say that there are two Wi-Fi networks available. One is IPv6 and one is IPv4, and I wanted to find out how many people had actually connected to the IPv6 network by Wi-Fi here. And how many people were able to get anywhere? Because I tried getting onto it, and it said bad connectivity. It didn't work properly. So, are you?
I did, but you have to opcode the DNS server IP addresses in IPv4. Otherwise, it won't work.
Deregulated industry such as this, when faced with such a difficult problem where the business case is a failure, the operations case is unknown, the entire supply side chain is not working, failure is an option, right? It is definitely an option. This is not a transition that will definitely occur. We have never planned to be where we are with less than 2 years left. This was not meant to happen this way. The last time we stuffed up the internet with NATs, guess what happened? Oddly enough, the applications folks said this is intolerable. These days, the only apps that work on the internet work across NATs because they have to. So that when failure is a realized option, then apps are not going to tolerate this. And again, I think the ball is going to get thrown back to more complex, more interesting applications that try and survive across realms and universes of connectivity at the IP layer. So just remember inside all of these exhortations that it's not necessarily a predetermined outcome, and that you also have to figure out as a business, what happens if all this fails? What do we do then as a business?
Just for those who don't know, here's Jeff Houston, from the chief scientist of Epinic now.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jeff. And he's one of those predicting all these address shortage, the famous website. Bertrand, thank you.
Yeah, I think we're touching a very, and thanks for the last comment, we're touching a very interesting distinction, which is the distinction between planning and coordination. If I'm not mistaken, coordination is the core mission of ICANN. Coordination is fundamentally, as a first step, bringing the different actors together so that they get a common picture. Like they integrate the fact that failure is possible, that they second integrate the fact that maybe something will come that will solve it, but that there are also maybe things that can be done to bring backward compatibility that was not implemented at first, that the notion of coexistence, dual stack, and all those things are part of the puzzle. But the key element that I took from the presentations is the notion that transparency for the user is fundamental. The user shouldn't have to worry about whether he or she plugs into whatever protocol or whatever.
for most of the users, and it will be more and more this way, this is just an appliance. It is just a utility. It's a plug. It's a connection, like the electricity. And it will be more and more this way. And so I just wanted to say this because the key element of coordination is finding the objectives. And this is why smooth transition is the right wording. We don't know how to do it. And maybe there will be many, many aspects. But taking into account the problem that is emerging and the fact that we have to collectively solve this problem is the very purpose of an organization like ICANN. All the organizations that have to take decisions on their own have to feel that they are part of the solving of a problem, that the objective is that we adapt for the future. And the characteristic of complex dynamic systems, it's not so much that it's deregulated. It's a, as in theory, the expression is complex dynamic systems. And emergent behavior is embedded in the kind of rules that you put. The web and the internet emerge because the enabling protocols contain the capacity to scale. Our behaviors must be functioning in the same way so that individual behaviors are encouraged in order for the resulting emergent situation to be solving or addressing the problem, which is accessibility for everybody, applications that function, and transparency for the user. So setting the objective is a huge part of the setting in common. The objective is a huge part of the of the tools we use.
We have two more speakers, but so far I think we've been dominated by French and British and Americans. We'd like to hear from the rest of the world after the two speakers, please.
Okay, I'm from the rest of the world. I'm an internet citizen.
Where are you from?
Oh, right. Okay, it happens that I'm in France. Okay. Most in Suisse. I think that there's something which is very important. The end user is in the core of this session. So I'd like to give the perception of that end user. Just one thing, by the way, actually I'm an IPv6 advocate to avoid any ambiguity on my speech later. And I have been involved for about 10 years in deploying IPv6, and I'm struggling to deploy it and push people to deploy it. But as an end user, I'm struggling every day I use IPv6 in production. I can't resist comparing it to IPv4. And people who are deploying IPv6 must be very careful not to degrade the IPv6 service compared to IPv4.1. And today, for the end user who try to play with IPv6, as soon as they find any problem, they go to the forums and they find the first solution, get IPv6 off because of the poor quality of the production networks. So we as IPv6 deployers, we have a great responsibility not to make IPv6 as a second zone citizen. IPv6 has to be deployed on the same level of quality. Otherwise, do some warnings, some disclaimers, it is under experimentation. If you claim it is production and it is not the same quality, you are dead. And you cannot give any argument for end users who are going to demand IPv6 to go for it.
I think we need some users like you to do some, you know, beta testing, right? Janet?
Thank you. Janet Hofmann, London School of Economics. I'd like to pick up Leslie's point, who said, yes, we know what the desired endpoint is, but there is no perfect plan to get there, and that's how the internet works. I wonder whether there is just one way how the internet works and whether that one way is actually carved in stone. What puzzles me now for quite some time already is that systematic attempts to coordinate across corporate and technical communities to solve this problem seem to be not very numerous and not very efficient. Is the capacity of the Internet for self-governance so low that this cannot be changed? I wonder why all these attempts now to reach out from the RIRs, why do they start it so late? Why did it not happen, say, 10 years ago when IPv6 was ready for deployment? That there is not a real business case for ISPs to offer IPv6 could have been known years ago. This is not new, is it? That there is no specific application for IPv6 that was known, I mean, at least when IPv6 adopted new facilities that it didn't have in the beginning. So this is something that really puzzles me. Thank you.
Let's move on, Frank, and then hear the answer later, perhaps.
What I'm curious is to go forward, and when is the end of IPv4?
Where are you from?
Oh, yes, sorry, I'm Frank. I'm from the Pacific Island, but I'm French too, and I'll speak in English. That easy like this? Sorry? Can't hear me? Yes. Okay. What I'm curious about is the end of IPv4. I know that IPv4 won't die when INA won't have any more allocation of IP address. But when you read all the recommendations from the EU and OECD, they talk about if you're not going to IPv6, then you will be missing the new economy and the opportunity into the economy. So at which level will we reach that missing opportunities in the new economy? How many IPv6 address compared to IPv4 will it be? And when will that happen? So that's where other economies will have to say, well, this is our deadline, our final date to be on IPv6. So have we started to look at this horizon when if you're not on IPv6, then forget about bringing new business?
And Thomas, and you, please.
Is this on? Just a couple of comments. I really think that it all comes back down to demand. Demand is what will fix everything. And in the absence of demand, things are going to flounder around. Because the problem isn't that the parties aren't coordinating with each other. The problem is that by and large, they do not have enough interest in being motivated to solve their piece of the problem. And if there was demand, if there were customers, there would be business cases. It's the lack of a business case that's driving. I mean, Jeff is exactly right. Fundamentally, the pain level of IPv4 today is not high enough. And I think, it's not going to happen now. I suspect we're still 2 to 3 years away before the pain level actually rises to where people might actually feel it. But we don't know they'll get there or not. That's sort of we have to wait and see. There's a lot of gnashing of teeth. We wish it were different. We wish people would, deploy. We wish. These things have been thought about for 15 years. It's not like we're just now realizing that IPv6 is not backwards compatible, quote unquote, with before. In some sense, that's just a definition and wording. That was known from day one. That was a design decision. You cannot have two technologies that are backwards compatible with each other if one is a change that the other ones do not understand. Backwards compatibility is really more of a, gets into definition. I mean, backwards compatibility often means that the new version continues to support the old version, therefore it's backwards compatible. Guess what? That is what dual stack is. Anyway, that's enough.
Thank you, Thomas. And by the way, he's on the ICANN board with liaison from IETF, I believe, right? We have two more gentlemen, one here and one back. So you the first. And we'll wind up soon.
Thank you. My name is Esam from the African Union Commission. I think the problem of migrating from the IPv4 to IPv6 is about mainly three things. It's demand, awareness, and consequences. To make this small analogy that in the year 2000 Y2K problem, the whole world was mobilized towards solving the problem because they know they are fully aware. They know what is the consequences of not solving the problem. And during so many presentations here, I heard about the year 2011 and 2010 for migrating from V4 to V6. And my question is, do we have another Y2K-11 and Y2K-10? Thank you.
And then we'll move on to you.
Is it just to, I've heard the question about why isn't this like Y2K or isn't this like Y2K? And the example, sort of my response to that is, this is like Y2K in the sense that you have to look at every application, you have to look everywhere under the hood to make sure things still work. It's not like Y2K in that there is no brick wall. It's not like you wake up and it's 2000 and all of a sudden it stops working. I mean, what happens when you run out of addresses? Nothing. It's exactly the same as it was the day before and the day before. It's just that getting usable V4 space, keeping the network running, is getting slowly more costly and so forth, but it's hard to sort of understand where the tipping point comes. That's the part we don't understand. And sort of my last point I was making is I think we need to keep in mind we're trying to upgrade an infrastructure that is being used by 1.2 billion people. You know, that is, when you think about that, it's incredibly hard to make a change that impacts so much of our underlying infrastructure.
Just directly, Ray, if so, please, but 20 seconds, and
yes,
he's waiting for many.
Speaking directly to Y2K, the important lesson to take from Y2K and apply here is the fact that it was a concerted effort of planning and identification that was the success that made Y2K a non-event.
Okay, my name is Michuki Mwangi from Kenya. Having been one of the people involved in the deployment and rollout of IPv6 in my country and Africa in general, I'll say one of the biggest challenges we are facing in terms of deployment is that we can't actually get native IPv6 out of Africa. We actually have to use to do tunnels. And if we are to roll out, and there are a lot of activities ongoing,
Mark Townsley.
Joined.
Governments are actually pushing IPv6 deployment. There is a lot of capacity.
Mark Townsley.
Left.
As a result of the RIR activities, AfriNIC. But once we set up, we can do peering at the exchanges. Three exchange points in Africa are doing IPv6, but their members can't actually get native IPv6 out of the region. And the main providers out of Africa are either European or American-based operators who actually won't provide this natively. One, they haven't switched it on. And secondly, there's no really significant financial reason for doing so. Now, my question to them will be, yes, Africa has very little traffic. We actually really don't have sufficient traffic to be financially a viable customer to, you know, for them to actually switch it on. But if we really need to move forward, what do we need to do for that to start happening? Because in Africa, IPv6 is really coming on. It will come on in over the next 12 to 18 months. But we need help to actually get it on moving. Thank you.
Anyone to answer quickly to this question? Or you have subsequent, perhaps, questions? Please, madam.
I will let the translator work. So please take your... Yeah, I'm going to stick in French. Je n'aurais pas beaucoup à dire puisque mon collègue du Kenya a déjà mis le doigt sur le problème. Nous sommes tous d'accord que le déploiement
left.
Nous savons qu'en Afrique, il n'y a pas beaucoup de trafic et que nous sommes loin d'épuiser les adresses sur IPv4. On peut se poser la question, pourquoi l'Afrique va se mettre à dépenser de l'argent, à faire de l'investissement pour se préparer pour IPv6. C'est pour des raisons d'être au diapason, de se préparer à cette mondialisation qui demande à ce que tout le monde se mette au même niveau. Et comme j'ai eu à le dire hier, c'est dommage que
c'est dommage, et c'est peut-être vrai aussi que mon collègue vient de dire qu'est-ce qu'on peut faire pour l'Afrique, qu'est-ce qu'on peut faire, mais je pense que c'est à nous, Africains, d'essayer de faire nous-mêmes. Nous participons à ces séminaires pour peut-être savoir ce qui se passe dans les autres pays, savoir comment ils le font. Mais aujourd'hui, la demande ne peut pas être très forte dans la mesure où les Africains ne peuvent pas tirer de profit, notamment le secteur privé africain, ne peut pas vraiment tirer profit des services qu'ils vont offrir, puisque les utilisateurs finaux n'en trouvent pas la nécessité. Si la demande n'est pas là, pourquoi on va s'investir pour cela? Et c'est encore un gâteau, un morceau pour le secteur privé international et étranger.
Merci beaucoup. For those like me who didn't have the receiver and don't understand French, Alain will translate you briefly. Thank you.
The question was, if I understood correctly, why should Africa, actually African countries, invest in the technology when the actual traffic is low and the demand is not there? I hope I've tried to summarize very shortly your point.
Thank you very much. Anybody dare to answer to, or it's our mutual challenge? I believe. Anybody from Afrinic? Somehow dropped out. Okay, any final burning comment? No question. Yes, Jeanette.
I would have a factual question that I forgot to ask. I've been told that some large internet service providers still ship routers to end users that do understand IPv4 only. If this is the case, then I find this actually surprising and wonder whether perhaps also ISPs need to coordinate their internal departments in a way that they get ready for IPv6.
The truth is actually even worse. The truth is that it's really hard to find CPEs that actually do support IPv6, so I would have a hard time to buy them and ship them to the customers.
I bet some CPs, but Thomas, you want to add or? Okay, please. Okay. Susan.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Wolf, and at the moment I'm speaking as an employee of ISC. We develop software. We develop open source, free infrastructure software. One of the things we've been doing a lot of work on is DHCP that does V6. That's not something that has been widely and freely available. Comcast has actually funded us to do that work, has come to us and said, we need our vendors to do this. As more people like him come to more people like me and say, this capability is needed, and then pony up the bucks, it becomes easier. But it does take the realization of the need, the planning, the commitment, and then the getting it done. And that all takes time. Right.
Yep.
It is, and to that extent, yeah, what I'm saying is that that's working, but slowly, and there's a lot of friction.
The last one.
Lucy Lynch, ISOC. To speak just for a minute to the supposition that demand is, customer demand is what's going to drive this, I was pleased to hear both Mark and Alain say that for internal business reasons they were looking at this for themselves. And to speak to the African point, if you assume your current customer base is your only customer base, your business is dead. The next billion is your market.
Thomas, please.
Yeah, so to be clear, when I say demand, it's not just end-user customer demand. I mean, the bottom line, the example about what are ISP shipping to home customers is a good example. Well, if you go to the vendor that actually makes the box and say, could you please put IPv6 in it, they'll tell me, how much will you pay me? Because it's going to cost us an extra 25 cents per router to add V6 functionality. And when we're selling these things for $9.99 at Fry's, that cost point is our profit. And then the ISP comes and says, like, well, we're not going to pay you for it right now because we don't have people paying us. And you do the ripple thing. It's all about demand. And there has to be a business case for every piece to justify their level of investment to do the work.
No further extension. With the privilege of the chair, I'm sorry, but you can continue the discussion over your lunch with your colleagues or friends. I really appreciate many speakers came, some of them for the last minute contact, and also many people who came to this room and contributed and share. So last word, Paul Toomey, our president CEO, put a very interesting article in the Korea Times about a week ago about this issue, and concluding, I think it's relevant to all of you. No single organization, government, or individual is responsible for making this happen to fully deploy the IPv6. It's a cooperation effort between the many partners and players who already make the internet function as a single global interoperable entity. So that's our task. Thank you very much.